Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, I'm Steve Evans. Welcome to Business Daily, which is about food security. Does it mean countries growing their own?
That does not necessarily mean you produce your own food. Most of the people in the world who are food secure do not produce their own food. They just have enough income to be able to buy it.
And the Irishman working for the Saudi potato industry, the big question.
Are Saudi potatoes as good as Irish potatoes?
I would say so. I'm very much a connoisseur of potatoes and I love our potatoes.
But whose potatoes does he mean? Find out in Business Daily from the BBC. Now, what do people mean when they talk about food security? When the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization tried to define the term, it came across 200 different definitions. In the end, it defined it as a situation where, quote, all people at all times have physical, social and economic access to sufficient, safe and nutritious food. In other words, when nobody's hungry. But it's come to mean, in countries as different as Namibia and Britain, the idea of less dependence on imported food. Now, I'll come to the FAO in a moment, but first let's get two vignettes. From Saudi Arabia in a moment, but first from Fiji, where Semesa Sautu is a top government official.
The focus of our government now is towards agriculture, getting more innovative ways of new products that we can develop in terms of agriculture.
Like
rice. Now we're getting rice from different kinds of rice from that we can plant from Indonesia, and we're trying it out. It's been so very successful. And we're also looking at potatoes, which we were most reliant on New Zealand. But now, because we have highlands which are quite almost the same temperature as New Zealand, we can produce potatoes and really produce them to be able to meet our local demand.
What's going on then? Food security is the buzzword.
Well, food security is initially the priority word. And of course, food security and of course education on food, particularly at the lowest ebb of society, which is the village level.
Why are so many countries like yours, and in your case a very remote country, going into the global food market?
We have no choice, really, because we have to look at or source our markets from outside, particularly our neighbours New Zealand, Australia. And of course we have those satellite regional countries in the Pacific Islands. For instance, Tonga, there's Samoa, there's Vanuatu, who now are going to import root crops and vegetables from Rotuma, which is part of Fiji. And that is very important in terms of our economic growth.
And that was Semesa Sautu at a food trade fair. Saudi Arabia, too, is worried about food security. It's also growing its own potatoes and is securing grain supplies by buying and leasing land in Egypt to grow crops there for its own use. Kieran Ford, an Irishman who works in Saudi Arabia for the Tabuk Agriculture Company, told me about the Saudi potato industry.
Oh, it's a very big industry. There are seven very large agricultural companies, each one about 35,000 hectares. There are some that are more than that, but our one is 35,000 hectares. There are others that are up to 100,000 hectares.
Why? It's not the kind of place I'd imagine you could grow things, but you grow potatoes right through the year?
Yes, we grow about 25,000 tons of potatoes, but in Saudi Arabia itself, the production is about 500,000 tons a year from all the farmers there. The government about 20 years ago very much encouraged agriculture from a food security point of view.
Is food security a concern that we hear of Saudi Arabia growing food everywhere?
Food security is an issue, and unfortunately it's using up the groundwater reserves of the country. So the government is encouraging us and other agricultural companies to look for land overseas to grow products for supplying the Saudi market.
How does that work?
Well, there's the King Abdullah Initiative for Agriculture, which is encouraging agriculture companies with soft loans and grants to look in investor-friendly countries in Asia and also in the Arab world to invest in those countries. For example, we're winding down our wheat production over the next 5 years. The government has asked all agricultural companies to wind down the wheat until it's completely phased out by 2015. And they've encouraged us to invest in Egypt, for example. So we're phasing all our wheat production out in Saudi and moving over to Egypt to grow the wheat there. And that will be imported back into Saudi Arabia.
So what, do you buy land or lease land, or what do you do?
Lease land over a long period of time, where there's plenty of supply of underground water as well in southern Egypt. That's the way it's going with the agriculture in the country, because the government is very concerned about the groundwater resources that are there and they want to conserve them. So they want to go to countries which are open to investors and are investor-friendly and would welcome companies like our own and other agricultural companies in the kingdom to invest in their countries. It's like an understanding between the governments of the two countries. We want to have the land there to meet the security needs, food security needs of Saudi Arabia.
You're an Irishman, I can hear, even though you're based and you work in Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Are Saudi potatoes as good as Irish potatoes?
I would say so. I'm very much a connoisseur of potatoes and I love our potatoes.
By which you mean Saudi potatoes?
Saudi potatoes, yes, yes. I would say they're just as good, yeah.
But is the idea of being self-sufficient in food sensible? Isn't it the antithesis of trade, where each country makes what it's good at making and exports and imports? The great Scottish economist Adam Smith certainly thought so.
By means of glasses, hotbeds and hot walls, very good grapes can be raised in Scotland, and very good wine too can be made of them, at about 30 times the expense, for which at least equally good can be brought from foreign countries. Would it be a reasonable law to prohibit the importation of all foreign wines merely to encourage the making of claret and burgundy in Scotland?
The words of Adam Smith, clearly from the grave. Let's turn then to the UN's big global food organisation, the FAO. It expects population on this planet to rise from the current 7 billion to 9 billion in 2050, up by a third. But on top of that, people will be wealthier, so diets will expand, and no doubt waistlines too. The FAO reckons demand for food will rise by 70% by 2050. Not quite doubling, but not far from it. I asked its economist, Dr. Keith Wiebe, how that demand would be met.
Well, it will come from a combination of increased area cultivated in crops, but even more importantly, we estimate that 90% of that increase will come from increased yields on land that's already in production.
You use the word will, not might or should, but will. It's going to happen.
We believe that it will, yes. There are many technologies that are already available, many of which are used very extensively in the developed countries, but have not yet been taken up to the same extent in developing countries. In Africa, for example, yields are currently much lower than they are not only in the developed countries, but also in other developing regions. And that has to do in large part with the lack of access to inputs, lack of infrastructure that farmers can have access to markets to sell their outputs, and a lack of incentives for them to adopt those technologies that are already available.
What will persuade them to adopt these technologies? Will it be, or should it be, government action, or do you think the market's going to do it?
Well, it will take both of those. The markets certainly will provide incentives as demand increases that will put pressure on prices, and that will have a double-edged effect. For consumers, higher prices reduce their access to food, but for producers, that represents an opportunity for increased incomes. Taking advantage of that opportunity, though, requires a couple of things. It requires that higher prices actually reach farmers, and in many cases, in 2007 and 2008, those higher prices did not reach farmers because many countries imposed export restrictions to try and isolate their markets from the global market. That meant that many of the higher prices that farmers in the developed countries enjoyed were not able to reach farmers in the developing countries. And as a result, we actually saw quite a very large supply response in terms of global agricultural production in 2008. We had record harvests of cereals, up 7%, in fact, in 2008. But the increase was very different between developed countries and developing countries. In developed countries, cereal harvest rose by more than 13%, precisely because farmers were able to take advantage of higher prices. In the developing countries, harvests rose by less than 3%.
So out and out, it's the market that was allowed to work by rich countries, and farmers responded. they grew more. And in poorer countries, governments intervened and kept prices down, and so farmers didn't respond.
Well, they faced a dilemma. It's understandable to an extent that they intervened because they wanted to minimize the impact of high prices on urban populations. But we need to keep in mind that that does also have a detrimental effect on producers in those countries. In the longer term, that means that developing country agriculture lost that opportunity to increase production, and perhaps they're not in as strong a position as they will be the next time around.
And yet I read an FAO report that says that the number of hungry people on this planet this year is rising to 1.02 billion people, and that's a lot of people.
That's right. It's up about 150 million people in the last couple of years, partly as a result of the current economic crisis and partly as a result of higher prices in 2007 and 2008.
So explain both of those mechanisms to me.
Food security depends not only on the availability of food, which is often the first thing that we think of, but also on people's access to food. And what we saw in 2008, for example, is a situation in which the world had produced more grain than it ever had before. But on the one hand, at the beginning of the year, prices were very high, so poor people, who spend a large share of their income on food, saw that their purchasing power declined rapidly because of the increase in prices. Later on in 2008 and subsequently in 2009, prices have been quite a bit lower, but at the same time, that's been accompanied by an economic crisis in which many people have lost jobs. Remittances from developed countries to developing countries have declined. Investment in agriculture has declined. Trade has declined. So many sources of income have declined. So whether it's increased prices or reduced incomes, both of those reduce access to food, which is really a fundamental element of food security.
What should I make of that phrase, food security? Because nobody'd be in favor of food insecurity. But on the other hand, we've learned, haven't we, that trading is what improves the lot of everybody. Fair trade, anyway. And this idea that countries should all start trying to grow their own is the antithesis of trade.
That's right. And I think we have to distinguish here between the term food security and food self-sufficiency. Some people would argue that the best means towards food security is food self-sufficiency. Food self-sufficiency, though, can be a very costly strategy in some situations. In other words, that's a strategy by which a country would seek to produce all of its food domestically. There are no countries in the world that do that today, and most of our diets depend very much on things that we enjoy from other countries. Most of the developed countries, for example, imports of coffee and tropical fruits and vegetables and so forth, winter vegetables, are things that developed countries either would have to produce in greenhouses or have to purchase from other countries. And conversely, developing countries benefit from imports of food from other countries. So food security does not necessarily imply food self-sufficiency,
well, except,
but often those two are unconfused.
Well, except that you know that because you're an economist and you think about these things, but isn't the common perception of food security that we must grow more of our own? And actually, you could be a very secure country in food terms if you import pretty well everything.
That's right. And this comes back to the issue of access, that those of us who are most food secure, whether we're talking about individuals or countries, are those of us who can afford to purchase sufficient food wherever it comes from. It might be produced locally, it might be produced somewhere else and imported. Whereas those who are the least food secure, the most hungry, are those who have the least ability to purchase sufficient food. What we often forget is that most of the world's poor, including most of the world's small farmers, are actually net buyers of food. They might produce some food, but they consume more than they produce. In other words, they depend on markets to have access to food.
So when I hear the phrase food security, I should prick up my ears and think a bit, because it's a bit of a slippery phrase.
That's right. You should think in terms of access to sufficient food for an active and healthy life. That does not necessarily mean you produce your own food. And as you've noted, most of the people in the world who are food secure do not produce their own food. They just have enough income to be able to buy it.
Dr. Keith Wiebe with Food for Thought. Should countries try to grow their own? Let us know what you think. world.business@bbc.co.uk. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Steve Evans. Well, you heard a moment ago about the impending explosion of demand for food. Should we then join the gloommongers in despair? Perhaps not, thinks Peter Day, whose global business programme this week dwells on one of the veterans of American environmentalism.
He doesn't quite go back to St. Francis, but Lester Brown has been in the environmental movement almost as long as it's existed. He started off as a boy farmer in New Jersey in the 1950s. Later, he joined the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where he travelled widely and started worrying about the state of the earth. And he's been doing that actively, vocally and influentially ever since. Lester Brown founded the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. in 1974. It became internationally known for its gloomy annual reports on the state of the world, charting global erosion, pollution and degradation. In 2001, he stepped up the pace by starting a new organisation called the Earth Policy Institute around the idea that the world needs a specific survival plan. He's now produced four successive editions of the book Plan B. And Plan B 4.0, Mobilising to Save Civilization, has just been published. Like so much of what he's written, the book is full of grim foreboding shaped around likely global food shortages in the coming decades. To a USA seemingly not ever so worried about global warming, Lester Brown has been trying to point out the big pressures on global raw materials if China develops its consumer appetite to the same extent as America has done. In that case, then, the majority of the world production of stuff such as oil and much food would be needed to satisfy simply one country, let alone the rest of us. This time is an even more urgent tone. Fears about melting ice caps and mountain glaciers flooding the Great Plains, where much of the world's food is produced, and disrupting the water supplies that feed them. Too much water and too little water, an unholy combination. Nevertheless, Lester Brown sees signs of opportunity. He's particularly taken by the way wind power is being developed in the USA at what he says is a cracking pace. I'm certainly bombarded with weekly news of investments. Lester Brown has a demanding target to be met by new forms of energy production and energy saving. Carbon dioxide emissions should be reduced, he says, by 80% by 2020, and more after that. Far bigger reductions than those talked about by politicians, though who knows what might emerge from the Copenhagen Summit Conference in December. Difficult but not impossible, he says. It has to be pointed out that there are bitter opponents of the sustainability idea who think that Lester Brown is just a perennial doomster who owes his fame to his propensity for making the flesh creep with his awful warnings. The complex arguments around global warming are difficult for non-scientists to assess, but surely there is not much wrong, and a great deal right, in learning to live within our sustainability footprint, just from the point of view of good housekeeping.
And more, of course, from Peter in Global Business here on the BBC World Service. Don't forget our website, bbcworldservice.com, for our podcast.
There's a BBC podcast for every area of business.
I'm Roger Hearing with the latest business news from the BBC.
From today's world business news to global trends with Peter Day.
So I've made a trip to the new China to see what impact credit crunch is having here.
And from the top of the morning.
Welcome to Wake Up to Money with Mickey Clark.
Hello, I'm Leslie Cohen. Welcome to Business Daily.
To the bottom line.
Who makes money when boom turns to bust?
Download your choice of BBC business podcasts at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.